With the internet, so much more is so easily remembered, I think, because incredible amounts of information is so easily brought together, and reminders come across my laptop or my tablet, even if I don't want them. Yesterday was kind of one of them, September 15th. It was a very sad day in my memory, international memory. September 15, 1963, Haight blew up the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. The massive explosion wounded nearly two dozen and took the lives of Addie Mae Collins, Cynthia Wesley, Carol Robertson, and Denise McNair. It was Birmingham's fourth bombing in 4 weeks. Four little girls were murdered in a terrorist attack. I guess you have to say those attacks still continue daily. The day is memorialized in a poem by Langston Hughes, and it references what happened on that date. It's entitled Birmingham Sunday. Four little girls who went to Sunday school that day and never came back home at all, but left instead their blood upon the wall with splattered flesh and bloodied Sunday dresses, scorched by dynamite that China made eons ago. Did not know what China made before China was ever red at all, would ever redden with their blood this Birmingham on Sunday wall. Four tiny little girls who left their blood upon that wall in little graves today await the dynamite that might ignite the ancient fuse of dragon kings, whose tomorrow sings a hymn the missionaries never taught in Christian Sunday school to implement the golden rule. Four little girls might be awakened someday soon by songs upon the breeze as yet unfelt among magnolia trees. I find it too easy to simply blame the Ku Klux Klan, shake our heads sadly, and overlook the reality of the unique American racism that ignited the fuse and that lingers strongly still. The deaths are not history. They are current events. Wounded victims, incidentally, are still alive, and one of the murderers from 1963 remains in prison today. Racism rampant in 63 is still alive and well, and you and I live comfortably beside it. But as the pictures hanging in our main hallway remind us, Black mothers all over our country are crying, grieving, and are very angry at the death of their sons and daughters. And my white privilege reminds me that I do not ever worry about my son or my daughter or my granddaughter being killed by an officer of the peace or by someone embracing the stand your ground racist mentality that allows us white people to stand our privileged ground and allow to be killed in still horrifying numbers, thousands of our fellow Black citizens. I do not hate bringing racism up, because what I hate a lot is racism, and I need to be reminded with regularity what I need to be most concerned with. And I know that these United States have always fallen short of its ideals and has always paid too little attention to our shortcomings and failures. The United States is built in way too many significant places on the shattered lives of victims of racism, genocide, slavery, and by scapegoating immigrants. And when we minimize the deaths of thousands, or even one, or overlook the detention, what is it now, over 12,000 immigrant children, We victimize them anew in a shower of bigotry. Bigotry was wrong in 63. It's wrong today. Children die when racists are empowered. We need to remember that. And let us remember the victims of American bigotry, especially today, the four girls who did not get to grow up and live lives like we have. They were killed by the privilege that nearly all of us here most of the time do not choose to pay attention to. Addie, Cynthia, Carol, Denise. Their souls are at rest, but as long as we have breath in us, our souls should not be at rest. Until we have done the maximum with our lives today to root out the racism that surrounds us and that indeed resides beneath each of these white skins as we benefit from the systems and structures of our society that privilege most of us because simply of our skin tones and doom so many others to fear and real dangers. It was this idea of fear that got me to change scripture lessons. Those of you who listen to me with great regularity, I do not hardly ever change. But when I was pondering this week, I ran across some work by Erin Wathen, and I owe her a great deal of thanks for where she zoomed me off to. She got me thinking that this summer has seen what our psyches desire. In the midst of the fear and danger of our time that has been projected onto the movie screens of our world. It's so very interesting to me, at least, to see what floated to the top of the list this past summer. From superhero sagas to epic sci-fi adventures, our favorite fictional heroes aren't just super, they are focused on larger issues. Our superheroes on the movie screens are leading resistance against corrupt leaders and systems. They fight against the powers of darkness, working for justice and the greater good. Now, I may see movies as an escape, but deep down, right, I think we want to see this kind of resistance take shape in real time. Especially in this current political climate, there seems to be a deep hunger for leaders who will help transform our communities in tangible and meaningful ways. When those leaders don't appear in real time, well, I think we take our $10 and we go to the theater. I think we love these movies to the tune of approximately $1 billion a year because we desperately want to see this kind of resistance take shape in our lives. And in this divisive and often toxic political climate, people are hungry for leaders who will transform our communities in the ways of racial and economic justice, LGBTQ equality, environmental protection, and compassion. Compassion for refugees and immigrants. The good news is this. Those realities are possible beyond the movie screen. Maybe the main characters of our favorite movies have something to teach us, however, about leading meaningful social change in each of our lives. Maybe that's why The Avengers made the biggest movie hit of the summer. The film was a culmination, if you're a comic book person, of 10 years of interwoven narratives and brought some of the biggest, most well-known comic book characters of all time into one battle. Infinity War was the highest grossing opening weekend movie of all time. Clearly, we had been waiting for this. The massive crowds gathered to see their favorite characters join forces together in one battle. And there came a day, goes the opening narration, which sounds a lot like the biblical, and it came to pass in those days. And there came a day like any other, unlike any other, when Earth's mightiest heroes found themselves united against a common threat. To fight the foes no single superhuman hero could withstand. And on that day, the Avengers were born. And that's how it came to pass, that Thor and Iron Man, Black Widow and Star-Lord, Doctor Strange, Spider-Man, Captain America and the Hulk, Black Panther and Gamora, Rocket and Loki and company all came together on one screen for one epic story that was really, however, many stories converging. Keep that in mind. What do these characters have in common? Well, for one thing, they've all got their own franchise and product line. For another, they've all got complicated backstories. They've all got personal flaws. And most importantly, each of these characters display not just superhuman powers, but a notable measure of fearlessness. Our scripture for today finds Jesus talking to the disciples. Just a few passages before this was the Great Commission. So part of the story is the extended instruction manual for the life of faith. Among other things, he wants them to know what it might cost them to live a life that is lured forward by God. He doesn't mince words. It might not be pretty, he says. It could be dangerous. People aren't going to like you everywhere you go. You'll not be popular with the most powerful people, who tend not to like it when you say that their power is not absolute. But here's the most important part, I think, of the instruction. Don't be afraid, he says. He says it multiple times, that litany of fear not, we hear repeated again and again throughout Scripture. Those words are often spoken by angels, sometimes by God, when things are about to get epic. Fear is a tricky thing, isn't it? It can get us out of a life or death situation. If you've ever been chased by a bear, fear's great. That surge of adrenaline makes you run faster or bicycle faster. It's a wonder of evolution. But if we hang on to fear too long, we literally never move at all. We become frozen. It becomes our default position, and our body and our brain starts to have a hard time distinguishing that bear from a person who just looks different than us. September 11th, that dark anniversary that we observed again last week, makes us recall how the fear of that day was so palpable. Everything was chaos. And nobody knew what to believe or who to trust. People in New York City and Washington, D.C., they were literally running for their lives. That's understandable. In that moment, fight or flight helps us survive disaster. Running is good. But in the days after, people began to cling to that fear as the new status quo. The fear of the unknown became fear of the other. Fear of the Muslim, fear of the immigrant, fear of anyone with dark skin, anybody with a head covering. Political opportunists amped up that fear. They leveraged it into very effective rhetoric that would solidify their own power, perpetuate misunderstanding, and further marginalize those whose looks or lineage made them stand out. Fear became not a survival instinct, but a daily mode of operation. And in many ways, I think that fear is what moved us towards the current political climate that we struggle against today. We've all been inundated with ads for the upcoming election. I'm already hitting the mute button. But I remember 2 years ago when Trey was running against this woman. There was a certain mailer that came out from one of our local representatives. And on the front, it featured an image of a shadowy, sinister-looking figure in full jihad gear, whatever jihad gear is, right? And it said, in a font that looked like the title screen of a horror movie, "Have you met your new neighbor?" And the text on the other side outlined how this candidate would protect us from Muslim terrorists that are trying to infiltrate our communities. It was straight up propaganda, stoking up the post-9/11 fears of all things Islam. But that representative won. And he isn't the only leader who's been propped up by their promises to protect us from that vague and villainous other, however fabricated those threats might be. When people are already afraid and need someone to be afraid of, or if you usually run entire campaigns on build that wall, this is what happens. The impulse to fear may be normal, but for disciples of this guy that we call Jesus our Christ, our call is not to be afraid, our call is to resist. Not just the powers that tell us to be afraid, but to the impulse to have fear itself. We are asked to rise above basic fear and transform the reality of our narrative into some sort of a new life. For the Avengers, the embodiment of that fearful voice was an imposing villain called Thanos. Like all the characters, he's got a compelling backstory that makes him complicated. He's got this misguided sense of benevolence where he sees the planet's resources depleting. And he thinks the only way to save life itself is to destroy half the population, that side of the sanctuary. Well, in polite circles, we call that genocide. It's not cool. In his own mind, his intentions were good for this group. But that desire to save life is warped by his own ego, and it becomes a death wish for all of life as we know it. His philosophy amounts to trickle-down economics at its finest. And like all such economies, it's rooted in it and perpetuates a fear of scarcity. And that fear makes him a monster. In taking on Thanos, in trying to keep him from acquiring enough power to destroy life as we know it, the Avengers aren't just fighting a bad guy, they are fighting the force of fear itself, the baser impulses that drives all of human evil. And that's exactly what Jesus calls us, the disciples, to do. He sends his disciples then out into the world's economy of fear and scarcity. He arms them with good words. He tells them not to be afraid. He tells them that they are to bring not peace, but a sword. I find this to be one of the most difficult passages in Scripture because we know Jesus to be a subversive force of radical nonviolence, and yet he's talking about a weapon. I think it's because he knows that their message will be perceived as a weapon. He knows that powerful people will react violently to a gospel that seeks to uproot the world's power structures. The message they bring will unsettle everything, from the economy to the government to organized religion and the family system itself. And it's not always popular to be the voice of resistance, the voice that says there's enough room for everybody at the table. There's enough room for the stranger and the alien. The voice that says our greatest threat is the people who keep us small and afraid. They're welcome to the table too. He knows that the good news will be deeply divisive in circles where people like to rely on their own strength. Their words and their radical witness to God's universal love will subvert status quo and make them terribly unpopular with powerful people. And as we all know, the real powers of darkness always take on human form. Into that mission field, Jesus sends not just one, not just sending John out by himself. John, you go out and do it for us. But he sends out a body. He sends out not one, but two, not five, but all of them. He sends them out as a body. He sends them out as a church, as a community of like-minded believers, a full force of power and witness. Because if you're going to fight evil for real, the first thing you do is organize. The first thing you do is you assemble. In our own work at First United for Faithful Social Change, I think this is the thing that most effective organizers know. They know how to assemble the powers of community, in particular a marginalized community, to advocate for itself, to stand up for itself. They know that once you've got enough people working together for a common cause, those individuals start to recognize their own power and they can't be made afraid again. There's a group of kids gathered after the Parkland, Florida shootings called Students Demand Action. They're part of a national movement of youth who are getting politically active, working for common sense gun reform in ways that we, their elders, have simply failed them. They're mobilizing young people to get out to vote. They're engaging their lawmakers. They're taking the microphone in public spaces, and they're a force to be reckoned with. And as they model for us what it might look like to get out of our comfort zones and demonstrate for causes that matter, not just with phone calls and emails, but with a physical presence that knows no fear. That's what I want us to remember this morning. There are many kinds of resistance. Watch for it. Learn from it. See where people are organizing. Stand up for the vulnerable or giving something that hurts a little, even if it's just a measure of our own comfort and security. We need to watch for the folks that are doing those things. But mostly I want us to remember that not all heroes wear capes. What really makes Avengers super is not their superpowers, but their power over fear. Their willingness to step into a battle with no certain outcome. I follow a faith and film blog, and the author noted how grim the Avengers' chances were in actually defeating Thanos, and he put it at about 1 in 14 million, but says, and I quote, "But this is what heroes fight for. Not for certainty, but for possibility. A little thing called hope." That is why, despite the film ending with many of our heroes blowing away as dust in the wind, I found it to be an incredibly life-affirming piece, end quote. Real heroes get no promise of victory. Darn it. They just pour their considerable strengths into hope. They resist. Not just the evil of the world, but the evil of baser human impulses and the darker powers of fear itself. You know, one of the things that all the Avengers had in common, apart from their fearlessness, was their loneliness. They've all got these backstories of being misfits and outcasts, feared for what's different about them, which is also what makes each of them so darn great. But in the epic saga that brings them all together, they are transformed by being with each other. A Christianity that entertains a pessimistic, negative worldview is hollow. It's an empty shell of what I think Jesus really came to offer. Rejoice and be glad, Jesus says. And in response, some Christians, well, they fear strangers. They cower behind walls and guns and fail to see God in the natural beauty that we all pollute. Some want freedom to discriminate in the name of religion, while others want freedom to live into their full potentials. Some strive to dismantle systemic racism and bigotry, while others struggle to keep it intact. Some face the world with fear, while some hold on to hope, hope for dignity and equality and fairness. The message of Jesus, I think, is hope. Hope for tomorrow, hope for a better world and a better way. The love of God is ours to embrace. As St. Paul wrote to the church in Corinth, love is patient, love is kind. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always, always perseveres. And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of these is love. The message of the Bible is hope. The hope of the Israelites looking for freedom. The hope of the apostles trying to follow the way of Jesus. Hope follows Jesus into a deserted place without food for the journey. Hope is going on that journey with 12 empty baskets and returning with the baskets overfilled. Hope is actively engaging in positive ways to help improve the lives of strangers. This is the power of us, the gathered body, the church, the many gifts in one spirit in which we are all called to serve. Like the disciples themselves, real Avengers, don't go it alone. First, always, they assemble, then they go down and have lunch, and then they go out together to do the work to which we are called. Let's go to lunch, remembering those four young girls blown apart by racism. They still need heroes, and the time in your life is still available, right? To be fully used by you and God and us as a team, as a community, assembled to eat lunch and then to work, for the fields are still ripe for the harvest. The time is still ours. I have great hope for what we can still do.